Hey listeners, if you're working on a manuscript, we'd love to help. Email us about our novel mentorship program at napleswritersworkshop@gmail.com.
Welcome to Why Is This Good, a podcast by the Naples Writers Workshop. I'm Christine and I'm here with John. Hey, John.
Hello.
Okay, it's my turn. And I picked a story that was also submitted by a listener a while ago, but it's called The Wedding Party by a writer, Taylor Cook. She took a drag from her cigarette and turned her attention out to the dark, out that way, where somewhere the ocean was heaving faintly. "Where are y'all staying?" "What's that?" she asked. Before I could repeat myself, she groaned and said, "God, I'm so bored. If you marry me, you can't be so boring." "Are you always this way?" I asked. "Listen," she said, "my sister's a sweet one. You'd like her better than me." "I think they're talking about you in there," I said, nodding to the window where the bride and groom had sectioned themselves off in a corner. The rest of the party went on, and those two discussed something, it seemed, seriously, tiredly, and occasionally they still gestured this way to the maid of honor in me. She watched her sister for a good while, with her hand set absently still on my thigh, as if it were not a thigh. "Poor sissy," she said. "She's apologized for me her whole life." She was quiet for another moment. She said, "All the troubles of my life I made for myself, I know that, but even so, it never felt like I had much say in any of it. Are you listening?" "Sure," I told her. "It doesn't matter anyway." "Listen," she said, "you should leave me alone for a minute. I can feel it. I'm just going to be mean to you. I can't help it. Come back in a minute and I'll be better to you, darling," she said. "You'll hardly recognize me." So I left her alone for a minute. I slipped out from beneath her and settled her onto the bench, left her my pack of cigarettes and the lighter, and went off toward the bathroom. The wedding party, as I passed, grew quiet, and the boys leaned against their upright pool sticks with one arm over the other, and the sticks heeled against the floorboards. In the bathroom mirror, I saw myself and decided I was a bit drunk. I wasn't matching up quite right with my reflection. Though, I thought, being drunk was all right, since I'd never had much luck with women when I was sober. Even my fiancé, though she didn't drink much, she and I had seemed to spiral through the room when we first met. Then I heard a sort of commotion come muffled through the door. I went out to see. An argument had broken out between the maid of honor and her sister, and the groom was in the center shouting along. The sister, for her part, never much raised her voice. She was crying, though. I motioned toward them, but a couple of the groomsmen with their pool sticks shouldered into my path, and one held up a hand and said, "Hold off there, guy." "It's all right," I said. Another groomsman shouted over, "You've had enough fun, buddy. Why don't you get on, huh?" The groom had reached for the maid of honor's wrist, and she'd yanked it away and went on now, even more loudly. "All right," a bridesmaid shouted, "we're out of here. Close out. Load up." Yeah, so this was recommended, and what I kind of realized by the end was this is a really good example of the kind of story you would tell a friend of yours where, oh my god, yeah, so I met this girl, she was part of a bachelorette party or bridal party or whatever, wedding party, at a bar, and she was trash, and we made out, and then I got into a fight with everyone. And it would be this, like, kind of trashy story where you're like, what were you doing, like, making out with this chick or whatever. But I think what literature does, what it allows you to do, is be so introspective and so inside a character's mind that this feels like an important story. And I would argue that in some ways it is, but in some ways it's just a trashy bar story too.
I think one of the cool things about this is that you're right, it has that feeling, that literary feeling of importance, but it's not necessarily about him. It is about him. It's his story. He's telling it. It's his point of view, but we're getting so much about her without being in her head.
Yeah.
That's like really neat how well she's drawn without being in her head.
Yeah, and just through dialogue, and obviously we get descriptions of how she's acting and things, but she's just such a, like, a full-blown character, you know, she's a big personality, so even just a little bit of dialogue tells you a lot about her. I, like, made a note in the margins, though, when I was reading, it's on page 166, so the scene that I just read, I stopped short, but eventually our main character ends up punching the groom. They get into an argument, and he punches him so that this girl that he's with can run away, and then he punches him a second time. It goes from, like, this, like, sucker punch almost to...
Well, it was an accidental. He accidentally hit him, so he's like, I might as well follow up.
Yeah, he, like, has the thought where he's like, I gotta finish it now. And then they, like, drive off, him and this girl, and they're, like, on a high, but it's, like, very quickly, like, coming back to reality. But there's this paragraph that I highlighted where I was like, this is an example of, like, the kind of prose, the kind of description that takes it from that trashy bar story where you're just like, oh, this is young people doing young stupid shit, to, like you said, it's this feeling of, like, importance. So they're driving, and he just punched the guy. It says, it occurred to me me then that my hand ached badly. There was a heartbeat in my knuckles. My three middle fingers went hot and stiff. I worked the shifter with my palm and my thumb and pinky and let my injured fingers turn purple and tremble aloft as though they commanded, strung beneath them, a miniature marionette to act out the shivering jig of my anguish. The highway was thin and empty and wove us along the coast, in and out of the tree line, the ocean coming in and out of view like a dream, I thought. Dark ahead and dark behind. It was getting cold, but she opened the window anyway, and the cool, wet air tossed her hair around dimly in the cab. Okay, that's the good stuff, right? That's the kind of description or the kind of observation that takes this from a trashy bar story where your trashy drunk friend is telling you to a writer telling you something that they're like, I'm being writerly about this, right? This is a moment that I'm going to stop and illuminate. And this feels like the coming down of that crescendo moment, right? Where they were just, oh my God, we just punched this guy, and now we're driving away, and now he's feeling his hand, and he's kind of thinking to himself, like, what have I done here?
Yeah, I mean, he's got a lot of those little moments in the story, like when he describes her face is like a bowl that he wants to drink out of. Like, that was a really cool description. It's evocative in a couple of different ways. It's evocative physically of a physical kind of composition, and it's also evocative emotionally. Like, he wants to drink out of it, right? He feels an attraction. He feels an immediate attachment to it, and not in a greedy way. That was well done. But there's like those moments happen throughout, that little writerly moments, I guess you can call them.
Yeah.
It's not just like, here's a paragraph where I'm going to be a writer.
Right.
So the whole thing is like cast in that feeling.
Right. Sometimes I think, and this is just me being like a curmudgeon or something, or like an asshole, or maybe I'm just jealous. But sometimes the ability to kind of like turn that on when you're writing something like this, and you're, I would argue, like, I don't know how old this guy is, but he's like our generation, right? Like millennials.
I'm not a millennial.
Well, John, I know you, so you, I can't, yeah, no, you're not. You're so old.
I'm like a silent generation. Yeah.
Yeah, right. But sometimes there's this like assumption that like certain young writers, unless they've earned their wings or whatever, either by virtue of writing a lot and being recognized for it, or having like this like lived experience, that stories like this don't deserve the kind of like literary treatment that they get. And they seem kind of like overwrought because of it. It's like if you were to write your first story about like your first dog dying, and you're just like, all right, I've killed 30 pets by now, and this either rings really true, or it rings, like I said, just like a young writer experiencing something for the first time, and it's more like a cathartic thing for them to write it out and journal about it than it is for a reader to absorb. You know, it's more for you, the writer, than it is for me, the reader, because I don't know what at your age or stage in life or with the specific situation you can impart to me. So sometimes I wonder if someone like Taylor had a phase like that. I know I had a phase like that. I think it's part of the process. Like, if you've ever read something that you first wrote and you want to puke and you're embarrassed and you want to burn it, I think that's normal. And I think it comes from what I'm describing here. And then I think eventually you can probably arrive at a stage like this where, I don't know, you know what to focus on, what not to overdo. I think in 15, 20 years, this guy will be 10 times better than this even, because there are paragraphs like that where I'm like, ooh, you're bordering on what feels like to me this like writerly tone that is put on. You know?
Yeah. I sometimes react negatively to those moments in stories. You're like, okay, that's a little much.
Yeah.
You don't need to do that for everything. I didn't feel that way in this one. See, there's this thing we do with, like we've talked about in the podcast, like the writer's eye, right? Like being able to see things in a new, interesting way. And then that's what you're trying to impart in your audience. Like, yeah, it's an ordinary story, but let me tell you the story as I understand it, because I'm a writer. I have that eye. And then part of that eye is being able to see those details just in a different way. It casts a different light on them. And we do it with words. So you have to like punch up the rhetoric. You got to punch up the language here and there so that you can show how you're seeing things. I think in this story it works, but there are stories where you're like, not right now.
Yeah. I enjoyed the story. I think it does work. And I like the section that I read. But like I said, whether it's from a point of view of me understanding this Taylor guy, you know, this concept of like writing about something like this, that, you know, if you're Salinger and we're reading it 100 years later, and we know who Salinger is and was and what his reputation ended up being, he could write about anything. And you're like, that must have been worth writing about. And then there's something like this where I'm like, oh, I feel like I've been in this situation, haven't we all? Where you're drunk at a bar and like somebody goes off and does something and there's an argument about it, and deciding to write about that, like you said, it's the writer's eye to like impart the feelings, or to say like, I can show you what about this is important. But I think the other thing is like, I can tell you what it's like to be there because you've been there. And if you want to read it and come along for this like similar journey, then I can also shoehorn in some of these things that I found were unique to my situation. So I don't know. Doesn't feel like a coming of age stage story, but it's like I said, it's like we all have a drunk night at the bar story with a larger than life character even. And then it's like, I don't know, maybe it reminds me of Cat Person 2, where the New Yorker suddenly decides to pay attention to things that millennials are experiencing and describing. You know what I mean? Where it feels kind of, I don't know. It's like looking at your 12-year-old and saying, isn't he pretty good at art? And you're like, yeah, he's okay. You know, I mean, well, he's going to be really good one day.
The situation's different, but a Priest Pancake story we read that was Trilobites, where he's with that girl in that abandoned factory or something. It's like, it has a very similar feeling to it. Like, she's got something else going on and he's being dragged along, right?
Yeah.
And it's a similar feeling. So it's just, you could probably find 100 stories that have that same feeling, that same idea. It's just like, I think the key to what makes it special, I guess, is just how evocative it can be.
Yeah. And I feel like I'm just shitting on the story. I'm not. I enjoyed it. I think I'm pointing out what are potential pitfalls for a writer that is on the cusp of this age with this kind of material or like premise. But the section that I read, like I said, it precedes this fight, and the fight itself is like exciting. And then there's just like this like come down. And then like, maybe that's the other part of what's literary about this, is that if I were to tell my friends this story, I would stop at the part where I drove off into the sunset with this girl, you know, and I wouldn't tell you what it felt like afterwards, that I felt hollow and this felt stupid and we were suddenly bored and just stuck with ourselves and this wasn't as exciting as we thought. And, you know, we went back to my place, but it wasn't that fun. And that's it, right? You would end on the high note. And what this does is capture what feels like, I would say, like a pretty like universal human experience, where this thing you thought you wanted to do, big or small, just doesn't feel like you thought it would when it's over, right? Like we said, he kind of accidentally gets into this bar fight, but you know, you'd think it'd be just the night of your life with a girl like this that's just unhinged and let's do crazy stuff. And it's really not. He's like, now I'm driving around Miss Daisy and she's bored with me.
That's interesting. It's like we're talking about epiphanies in the most recent one, and I don't feel like he ever has one. It's like this is all leading to hers.
Yeah.
He has the moment at the end of it and he just gets to be along for the ride.
He seems like, at least like in this point in his life, like his relationship with his fiance is kind of unclear. He keeps calling her his fiance, but they don't live together. At the very beginning, he talks about how she plans to maybe sell the place where she's living, but he's not even like privy exactly to her thought process on timeline or anything. So you're like, how often are they talking? And then there's like a line that I was originally going to read before I decided I wanted to get like dialogue from this girl in there. But his fiance has cystic fibrosis. And then there's a line that says, the most lonesome thought of my whole life is that someday, like a stranger, I will hear it through the grapevine that she's died. And so you're kind of wondering, like, have they broken up or are things rocky right now or whatever? Like, he's at least in the headspace where he's not going to be with his fiance when she does die. And they usually die pretty young. So I don't know. You're thinking that maybe like they're not together. Anyway, point being that the time in his life that we're coming to this character, he feels just like just a bump on a log. He's just going with the flow. So when a character like this at a bar comes up to him, he gets swept up in it. So it is his point of view, but like you said, it's not his story. He's not making conscious decisions. He didn't go and hit on this girl, right?
Yeah.
She is the ball of fire that like says, let's make out now. Let's piss off the groom. Save me, save me. And so he accidentally punches the guy and then he punches him again and then they drive away and he's like, let's go here. And she's like, no. Like, he's driving the car, but he's not in control at any point in the story.
The way that it launches, like he sets up like the apartment thing and some other stuff, but then the wedding party shows up. And I think the line is, a wedding party showed up, literally that. Anyway, so the girl appears on stage and the way she looked was something I felt in my guts. Her face was as small and round and as delicate, it seemed, as a bowl, which you might turn up in your hands and drink from. And before the shame of all my life could well up in me, as it usually did on such occasions, she came over and said, you want to buy a maid of honor something to drink? So we sat there for a while and got drunk on vodka and sodas. It's like she initiates everything, right?
Right.
He sees her. He's about to like,
go into like a real shame spiral. It wasn't just like he was dismissing the possibility. He was like, when I feel this way, I feel like shit about myself afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. But instead, she comes over. She starts it, which I don't know. I wrote next to that section, I wrote moral stakes, because it's like, who's initiating things? Who's making the decisions along this way for what's about to happen?
Right.
That's another reason I feel like it's her story, because she's driving it.
Yeah. Well, okay. I was going to read this ending here. And to your point, I wonder if Taylor, the writer, is doing something whereby showing you that these people, at least our main character, is not in control. role. It's like his story, but it's not his story. He's not making conscious choices or decisions. Like, he's just along for the ride. Like, I think that might be the point of the story, because at the end here, they have this conversation that feels similar to that. So she's telling him a story. She's like, when I was a kid, she said, there was a boy I used to run around with. He took me here. His daddy had died just before, and he drove me around in his daddy's old truck all up and down the coast. I haven't thought about him in years until just now, and all of a sudden I sort of miss him again. I stood a few paces to her back and watched as she wrapped her arms against herself and braced against the ocean breeze, which whistled lonesomely through the grass. Has that ever happened to you? She asked. Which part? Something like that. Maybe so, I said. I can't remember. I'm sorry, she said. What for? Oh, I don't know anymore. Forget it. Sometimes I have this feeling like I've never once said what I really meant to say. She dropped the shell at her feet and went off to the car. I'm ready to see the place where you live now, she said, and so we went there. This feels like she's even remembering a time and a place in her life where she was, again, a passenger, but this other guy was kind of in control. And it doesn't seem like she misses him so much as, like, she misses, like, what he offered to her life at that point, right? Where somebody's, like, directionless and somebody else steps in and says, I'll take the wheel, you know? And you just have to be there. And it feels like that's what's happening for this narrator now, right? If you told this guy, let's go do meth, he might do it that night. And if you told him, let's go to bed early, he'd probably do it, right? He just wants to be told what to do, it seems like. And there's, like, comfort in that, because maybe he's, like, depressed or whatever, but it's those kinds of in-between things that happen in your life where somebody else just calls the shots. It's like, you know, when you have a job, but you're really depressed. You don't know what to do. You don't know what to do next with your life, but you do know that every morning you have to wake up and go to work, right? There's something, like, anchoring you to this reality with everyone else's experiencing, even though maybe everyone else seems to be happy and in control of their life at that point. And he's like, I'm gonna go to the bar, and there will be other people at the bar, and they'll tell me what to pay attention to and what to think and feel. And she seems to have been remembering a time in her life too where she was like, I kind of miss being around this kid, even though I didn't want to, like, love him or whatever. I don't know. I wonder if that's, like, kind of the point of the story, because by the end you're kind of like, this guy, he's just, like, unmoored. He's just, like, out to sea. He's not very sympathetic because of it either. But when you see this other character, his foil, this woman who feels, like, full of life and personality and agency, she's also reflecting, it seems like to me, on a time where she didn't have that. And she feels kind of directionless now even, right? She's doing a bunch of stupid shit.
That's an interesting dichotomy, like, driver and passenger. I feel like he is literally driving her around, but he is the passenger for this, especially in the early part of the conversation, because she drives everything. I say this story is about her, but it's really about both of them, because it has to be. That's why it's told in the first person. Otherwise, it would be something else. So her revelation or moment at the end there allows him to have an equal, possibly opposite revelation, which is unstated because he's not saying it out loud, but it's there. Which, that kind of thing we're describing here at the end, where the two things kind of tie off on each other, makes a good story. That is one of the things that raises it above other, what we were saying before, those kinds of stories that don't quite get there.
Yeah, yeah. You wouldn't want to read a story just rehashing a night like this unless you had something to say about nights like this.
That's right. I almost mentioned it when we were just saying, like, when she was driving the conversation. But the things that I really wanted to point out about the story, like, the main thing that I reacted to was, there's these little moments in their dialogue, which I thought were so masterful. We've talked about how some of the best dialogue shows the way people actually talk to each other,
right?
Is they're not always listening to each other. They're having separate conversations, kind of overlap. But these moments where he'll ask, like, sometimes it's an explicit question, like, says, what's your name? I asked the maid of honor. She looked at me with this bored expression that sliced right through me. Do you have any cigarettes? Sure, I said. These moments are characterizing her in such a clean way without saying anything. I told her I didn't think that we'd get married. This is after she starts joking about getting married. And then instead of answering that or continuing on, she says, guess how much my sister's ring cost? She said, I don't know. And then on the next page, he's just trying to get stuff out of her. The way any conversation partner is like, where are you all staying? What's that? She asked. Before I could repeat myself, she groaned and said, God, I'm so bored. If you marry me, you can't be so boring. Right? It's almost a comment on the question, but it sounds more like she's trying to change the subject again.
Right.
She's driving. And that's, I think, one of the clearest ways, not clearest, that's, it exemplifies a really effective way to characterize somebody, a character in the story, is the ways in which they will drive a conversation or change the topic or not answer questions or avoid things. She doesn't do all those things in this, but those are the kinds of things that characters can do through these kinds of moments where there's, like, a break between what you expect the answer to be, like what a well-composed dialogue would be, versus this, like, shift to something else.
Right. Like, I like the section that I read because because I was like cracking up. Like, I can picture this where she's trying to like flirt with this guy. She's trying to keep it all like light and fun and like we're ships in the night. Like, let's just like bullshit and like let's do bits or whatever. And he's like, where are you guys staying? And she's like, God, I'm so bored. She doesn't even want to have a real conversation with him. So like part of what you're pointing out to me also feels like this redirection where she's trying to hold her own interest, right? She's like, I don't want to get to know you.
He doesn't matter.
No.
At that moment, he doesn't even matter. She's going through something else and he's just like this vehicle for it.
Yeah. Like the section you just read where she's like, how much do you think my sister's ring costs? He doesn't even like want to wager. Like if he had said $2 or 10,000, like whatever it is, like it would have been way more fun than, I don't know. It's like, come on, dude, give me something to work with. She's like doing sketch comedy or something, but she's the only one like in on the idea.
Yeah. This is how you get a sense of, like, besides that, there's also the other people's reactions to her, but the way she redirects the conversation whenever he's trying to get somewhere shows how she's feeling about herself that night and the whole situation without saying a word. It's amazing that you can do that.
Yeah.
Show a character do something by having them avoid something.
And I like I said, where she says, God, I'm so bored. Sometimes I think we also think that deft dialogue is dialogue that says one thing, but, you know, tells the reader to read between the lines. And this is what I'm actually thinking when I say this. And it's even a shock to read direct dialogue where someone's like telling you, like, I'm bored, instead of like, she looked away. She's like that big a character where she's like, I'm bored. And that dialogue is jarring. Like, maybe she's just like a rare character to see in the first place, right? And she's like, are you always this way? Or he says that to her. He's like, are you always this way? There's like a kind of honesty you can only have when you're first meeting someone. And if you were to say, are you always like this, you know, 6 months into knowing someone, it would be like an insult. But right now it's like kind of playful. Yeah. She's like, I'm bored. And he's like, are you always like this? Like, and they're having a little bit of fun with it.
She feels very earnest too.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And he is too. It's this interesting, like you said, it's very casual, but it's very earnest at the same time.
Right. Like, you know, aside from the fact that he did punch someone and he is currently injured, you don't feel like either of these people are putting the other one at risk. They don't seem like bad people or like, this is like a dangerous situation or anything. She's like happy to like get in a car with a stranger and like drive around with like no plan. And he's like kind of like, drunk all stranger. Right, I'll take you. Yeah, exactly. She's like, you shouldn't be driving. He's like, yeah, well, like, what are we going to do about it?
I shouldn't.
Yeah. Like, you're the one that told me to be your getaway driver. I'm trying to think what I think my takeaway, just my overall reaction to this piece goes back to what we talked about originally, which is that this is a throwaway concept unless you are a writer that wants to illuminate something about like the broader human experience through this. And I'm not saying that you can't have epiphanies at a bar, just that these encounters are in some way a dime a dozen. And like I said, unless you've had a million experiences like this, then you can't really hope to tell me anything about them in general. But to that point, like the takeaway being that that's all that writing is. Like sometimes I think people like sit down and they think they have to come up with something really exciting to write about. And it's like, you could write about your night at the bar if you had a thought about it. And if it feels important to you to want to share that experience with someone else, that's all I've ever enjoyed about writing is like I said, like underlining sentences in books where I'm like, I've felt that way. And until I've read it written that way, I've not understood it fully, or I feel understood and seen and heard. I identify with this character. So if you can capture something like really authentically or realistically or however, like that's in and of itself like a good part of writing. If you can just tell me what it's like to be at a bar drunk with a girl, that's good stuff. And then if you can, like we said, get to that next level, then that's even better. If you can impart something to the reader above and beyond just like expertly capturing something.
Yeah, you're making me think about like all the stories I haven't written that I want to write.
That are just like quiet stories in a lot of ways.
I remember there was a period when I was like, I want to come up with stories. So I'd go back over old emails and old stuff from like 20 years ago that is just
stuck.
What was I doing? What was I, just little events that I chose to write into an email. And I was like, could that be a story? Could that be a story? And there's a ton of them that probably could be a story. If I did exactly what you're saying, if I found why it stuck with me and put that into it and figured out how to express it.
And sometimes it's not just like that you've had this cache of stories that you've not done any work on. Sometimes it's like these are half formed and you haven't figured out what you want to say about it. You know, I have a whole list like that too, where you've experienced something or thought of something or like returned to something again and again, and you're like, I don't know what to do with it yet.
There was a story I submitted to the workshop that I was trying to rewrite to resubmit. And this is a few years ago. ago that I did this. But in developing that story, I was like, okay, what is this story about? Why am I so interested in it? And it's basically the same considerations. But eventually I worked out that, well, what I'm really trying to do is like this. And in order to do that, I need to go back a couple of scenes. I need to add more. I need to it needs to be a novel. Because the feeling is like about a whole year. It's not about the event. It's about everything that was like encompassed within all of that. And in order to explore all of that, it has to be bigger.
Yeah.
Because the feeling's bigger. The feeling is almost a place, right?
Right. I like how your conclusion is it's got to be a novel.
I know. So I put it in a drawer. I haven't
worked. Yeah, exactly. You're like, well, I don't have time for a novel, but at least I figured it out.
I'm writing other novels. I'm like, I have. Yeah, exactly. You know, that's another novel that I could potentially go to at some point when I need an idea, but writing other things at the moment. But it's not a short story. That's what I found out.
Yeah, exactly. So do you have another concrete takeaway other than that? Or
my takeaway was just about characterization.
Yeah.
And the way the dialogue did it. You could probably learn a ton from this story, but just a very minor concrete thing is just that dialogue stuff, redirection. Because we did talk about it before, but I feel like these really concrete moments, and they do different things. It's not merely trains of thought. It's not merely this character's thinking about that and this character's thinking about that, so they're not going to connect. It's she's actively driving somewhere else. She's like, I don't want to go down that road.
Yeah, she's avoiding things.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. A lot of times, like you said, we talk about like characters like accidentally misinterpreting what someone else says versus, like you said, like she's the driver in every sense of the word in this piece.
Yeah.
It makes me want to read other stuff by him because the couple interviews that I pulled up trying to figure out how to pronounce his name were like, oh, he's the writer of our generation.
Oh, really?
You know, I think we all are when we publish something, but.
Well, I did liken him to Breeze Pancake before, so.
Yeah, exactly. Know. Which means he's going to burn out fast, right?
I hope not. Well, he's already lived longer, so.
Yeah. How old was Breeze? I thought he was like 30.
He's like 27.
Jesus.
27 sticks in my mind because it's that famous musician.
27 Club,
like
yeah.
Jim Morrison.
Amy Winehouse.
Yeah, and Jimi Hendrix. That's who I'm trying to think of. But Jesus and Alexander the Great were 33, so, you know.
Yeah, Jesus. I know. I think about that all the time. All right. Thanks, guys.
If you enjoyed this episode, consider joining our Patreon. Your support helps us keep the show running. Find out more at patreon.com/whyisthisgoodpodcast. You can also subscribe to our monthly newsletter at napleswritersworkshop.com.